geographical surveys, mines, and so on.
Well, and, what about the military aspects of this? Did you ever?
There were none.
No, I realize that there were none. I'm wondering about, did you ever, you and your colleagues, then wonder when you were going to get some, say, fighter planes or a bomber or anything to...
At least I never did. I never thought of it. I enjoyed this bushwork.
You like flying. That's the trouble. You just like flying. You didn't care where you were going. Okay. You got that figured out. Now, this would be through 1931. You were especially involved with aerial photography. Is that correct, sir?
Well, I was involved in aerial photography right from the time that the detachment was started in Churchill.
That'd be the number one general purpose detachment? The
number one general purpose detachment. That was that was organized in 1929, and my first job was located up at Churchill. I was there at Churchill all summer, and doing some photography up there and various things. I don't want to go into too much detail on this. I'm trying to hurry through here.
Well, I'm just trying to think. Now, for 1931, basically, it was photography along with dignitaries and just general purposes, help everybody out. Is that correct?
Well, this was one job. Then I brought them back. This was one job. Now, then, the next job I got right after I got back. See, I said I got back on the 19th. Well, on the 21st, let me see. No, we got back on the 21st. On the 27th, I got word to go to Coronation Gulf and return. Now, that was to go up to Great Bear Lake, Hunter Bay, on the east end of the Great Bear Lake, which was the rendezvous of all the, where there were aircraft, there were usually about 10 or 15 commercial aircraft in there. Then go on to the Arctic Ocean. And
You would have no radio, no equipment.
I never had any radio at all when I was at the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Never. No real special equipment.
No radio was available. Mm-hmm. It was all contact flying. There were no beacons, there was nothing, you see.
Navigational aid, nothing.
Nothing.
Don't know nothing about nothing, eh?
Well, I'll show you some strip maps there in a little while if you'd like to see them. And then on the 4th of August, to Artillery Lake via resolution,
Reliance Coordinates
and Hay River.
August
30. That was in 1930.
August 30.
To Artillery Lake. And then on the 9th, search for missing aircraft. Now, I don't understand that at all. Number 44 photo collection. I don't know. I don't remember that at all. But I only spent 2 hours and 10 minutes on it.
Were there a lot of lost aircraft in that sense?
No. There weren't too many. This one here, as I say, I can't remember it. And there was one other one, an Air Force machine that was lost up in that general area. But that was after I left the Air Force. That was 1930, I think it must have been the summer of 1932, because I know I went up to the, knowing the area to some extent. McLeod, Earl McLeod, was the squadron leader there. And seems to me he phoned me to come up and discuss the matter, see if I could give him any hints. And the only thing I could tell him was look downwind, because a lost aircraft almost invariably goes downwind. They drift, you see, without knowing it.
Mm. Now,
this is some of the area that I was talking about there. Great Shave Lake. Oh, yes, here's your lines here, yeah. It's right on the end of this thing. And we were flying, this is an awful river, there was no nav, it was just full of rapids, up to Artillery Lake, which was the headquarters of the warden for this whole big area, the muskox, what do they call it, Filon River Muskox Reserve, Muskox Game Reserve, or something like that.
This is like Northwest Territory.
This is Northwest Territories. And incidentally, this was the track of the Russian satellite that went down.
Oh, yeah.
Right across here.
The one that just went down and landed in Canada, and this is the same track that you were flying back in 30.
Well, we were flying,
There's a lot of areas, I noticed from your map, there's a lot of areas that aren't marked.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is just the main, this is just water routes, actually.
They're just showing water routes, and the lower part of the map, which is close to the borders, the provinces would have topographic contours.
No contours.
Well, there's contours here.
Well, this isn't contours. In effect, it's rising ground. And actually, it's just gentle slopes. Right in here, I saw, I heard of, we landed at this island in here, which is
the Artillery Lake.
Yeah, which was the warden's headquarters. He had a cabin there. Incidentally, I told you that, I think previously, that on one of the trips, the second pilot crashed in here. He come into this place. This is high ground, the cliff perhaps 100 feet high on here. He came in this way and thought he was going to overshoot and tried to circle around, but he hit this rising ground and just toppled right over. Luckily, he wasn't hurt, but I was still circling. He had the crewman with him, and I told him to go ahead because I was carrying a full load of supplies. He went ahead and presumably sort of helped me beach my aircraft, you see. But I circled, I saw him, and I saw a puff of dust. When he hit the ground, a puff of dust came up, and I thought, oh my God, he got on fire. He looked just exactly like smoke. But it wasn't anyway. That was just one thing. But this isn't really high ground. It's not contours. It's gentle slopes. Well, when I took off from one of my trips here, there was apparently a herd of caribou in here that I hadn't seen. They were just grazing there. And when I took off, the noise of the engine had fallen out. Started them and they started to move. It just looked as though the whole hillside was moving. Exactly. It was all the whole thing. I couldn't make out what was going on for a minute until I realized what it was.
There weren't very many people up in this area.
Oh, no. There was nobody in here at all. Snowdrift is back in.
Now, your general task was civil aeronautics.
Civil Government Air Operations.
Civil Government Air Operations.
CGAO.
Photographic survey. And shuttling government officials around.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you would do this for all of 1930?
Yeah, I did it from 1929, actually.
Right to 32.
See, my detachment is called Number 1 General Purpose.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, what about leaving the actual flying and things? You flew quite regularly over a lot of unmapped and unmarked territory. I'm thinking generalities now and specifics in your case. You continue with this up until the early part of 1932. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Up to the fall of 1931, and then I was posted up to Cormorant Lake as the COC of the detachment up there.
And that's when you were promoted to flight lieutenant?
No, I was promoted to flight lieutenant in either the beginning of 1931 or late in 1930. I'm not sure which.
Mm-hmm. But now you become OC at which lake again?
Cormorant Lake. Cormorant Lake, which is 42 miles northeast of the Paw on the Hudson's Bay Railroad.
And what were you doing up there?
Nothing
to do, eh?
No, there wasn't too much to do, really. There was maintenance on aircraft. There were two or three aircraft in there. There was the odd trip down to the Paw for some reason either to get some supplies or to get something required for maintenance of the base. It wasn't very much. There were probably not more than three aircraft on the base. And my second pilot there was a chap who... I can't think of his name offhand. Anyway, he got in the RCMP, and eventually he was OC of the RCMP Air Division.
Not really.
And the funny part of it is that when I was released from the Air Force, I applied to the RCAF, the RCMP, wrote a letter to the RCMP outlining my qualifications and so on, and asking if they think about establishing an air service. I also contacted the Hudson's Bay people to find of establishing an air service. And neither one of them were thinking about it at that time. This was in the Depression, you see.
Well, this is what I was trying to get at before. Now, you're in the middle of the Depression. The Bennett government is in trying to make amends. There's a lot of talk about, did you receive a 10% cut in pay, do you recall, like the armies and others did, where they didn't cut your pay, they held back?
No, I think we were laid off.
You were just laid off. You didn't even get the niceties of a cut in pay. When it came to the actual layoff itself, and only permanent force people were to be kept on, I gather, and a few selected others,
No selected others. Because I was told that they tried very hard to keep a few of us, a selected few, on, but it was just made a clean sweep. As a matter of fact, Air Vice Marshal, you interviewed, you mentioned
Housen,
was the adjutant he was a flight lieutenant at Ottawa. And he was the final man that I saw in the Air Force. He said that they had been trying desperately to keep a few of us on, but without any success.
Now, did this come as a great shock, or has it been building up?
I was still at Carmond Lake.
Well, this is it. Yeah.
When I heard at Carmond Lake that some of them were being laid off, well, I don't know what my reaction was. It wasn't at that time. It was just some of them were being laid off. It wasn't the whole non-permanent Air Force. At least that's what I heard. I was out of touch quite a bit.
Yeah, you're really out in the hole there.
But eventually, I think it was in April. Word came through that I was to report to Winnipeg. And I forget now who they sent up. They sent somebody up to take over my job anyway. I forget now who it was.
And then what did they tell you?
Well, then they said that Squadron Leader Anderson was the man there, and he said, regretfully, we have to let you go. I want to show you the...
What did you receive from Department of National Defense Air Service?
Well, that was Squadron Leader Anderson from...
This is from Squadron Leader Anderson. To whom it may concern, this is to certify that Flight Lieutenant J.C. Hellman has been employed at the Winnipeg Air Station as an officer pilot from 29th June 1928 to March 1932 and is being released owing to a reduction in the air service. And it goes on to state that Mr. Hellman was a great pilot, a very good pilot and exceptionally well qualified in seaplanes, 4 years experience, North and Western Canada, Hudson's Bay, Rocky Mountains on the west, international boundary to Herschel Islands in the Arctic Ocean, and qualified in oblique and vertical photographic operations. And Mr. Ullman is a flight lieutenant. Ullman is a very conscientious and capable supervisor and a good administrative ability, and is strongly recommended for any position. And the difficulty was that you weren't permanent force.
That's right.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
And the only way I guess you could get into permanent force then was to have, before this, was what, an engineering degree or some very technical pilots, I think.
Yes. There wasn't any thought of taking on... See, this was copying the Royal Air Force. They had non-permanent, short service, they called it.
Short service
there. And this was a copy of that. It allowed a certain degree of freedom in eliminating people who didn't turn out to be so desirable. That was one reason, I suppose. Another reason was that they couldn't, didn't have the money to build up a permanent, too large a permanent operation, you see.
Well, what about the feeling when you were told that it was over, and the feeling of your colleagues that we're not permanent for it?
Well, I was one of the last ones in the Winnipeg Air Station. I may have seen two or three of the others. I'm not sure.
So they sort of hung on to you as long as they could. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
The others got were closer at hand to be let go, maybe.
Yeah. That's probably it.
And was there not a lot of resentment, sir, and a feeling of...
A few. I remember a very few did feel kind of let down. But I don't know. I more or less took it in stride, I think.
Well, this is the Depression, though.
Yeah.
It didn't bother you then?
No, not really. Not really. I've always figured I could land on my own 2 feet somewhere.
You will have them
in
2 feet.
I had a great deal of confidence in myself. It was pretty bad.
Fair enough. Now, with the Air Force only going to permanent force and a small force, a technical force, now, were you placed on a reserve list? Or,
I'm not sure
the designation. Do you recall
that? Yeah, placed on the reserve. And a little story about that, too. In 1937, Jock Shields and I, Jock Shields was the, he was a lieutenant, he was a flight lieutenant too in the Air Force, but he resigned. No, he was let out. Now wait a minute, he applied for the, they were starting up airmail, you see, in 1929 it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the ones that put in an application to the, well, it handled the Department of, what was it? I forget now what it was.
Supply?
No, it would be Department, it would be something, it would be the, oh, isn't that funny? Anyway, it had to do with aviation in Canada.
With the Air Board?
No, the Air Board was discontinued. It wasn't the Air Board. It was, well, anyway, he applied there, and they were taking on, they were starting to put in range beacons and so on, and or inspectors, I should say. And he was applied for a job as an inspector on aircraft. And I think he left around, somewhere around 1931. But anyway, that's a long story. Another little side issue is that he and I were both at the same training shot at Boscombe Downs in 1917, and we hadn't seen one another since then. But anyway, he and I were talking it over one day. We were required to report by letter annually on this reserve, and he and I were talking it over one day, and we said, "What's the use of putting there today if there's not going to be any war?" This was 1937, so we just sent our resignations in. You see. Otherwise, I would have been called up at the start of the war, regardless of my, well, I might have gotten an exemption for a while because I was in a provincial government service. But in any event, I didn't. And I did ask the minister of our department to write Ottawa and volunteer the whole air service to go down on the east coast or the west coast, the east coast particularly, where they thought there might be submarine trouble. We were accustomed to water flying, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we might have been useful there, but that was turned down. They said, stay where you are. You're doing an important job where you are. Stay where you are, you see.
What about the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan?
Well,
did they affect you?
No, they didn't. Well, later on, I didn't like being out of it, I might say, but I was told that the deputy minister said, well, if you leave, there may not be an air service to come back to, for one thing, you see. And then 1939 and 40 was quite a bad fire year, and there was all sorts of jobs to do, you see, that was important in itself. And I kept, but eventually I did write a letter to
Powers, Chubby Powers?
No, to Johnson, Geo Johnson, whom I knew, actually. I almost pulled out of the drink one time. That's by the way. But in any event, or did I write to Sleman? I may have been Sleman that I wrote to, and he passed it on to, as the Johnson was the director of personnel.
No, this would be what, the second war.
Yeah. Yeah, this was about 1942. And I got a very nice letter back from him. I knew John, well, of course, as you say, I knew Johnson. And he outlined the procedures. I said that I didn't want to be to go in and be stuck in some corner. I thought I had enough qualifications to be kept pretty active, you see. And incidentally, I know some of the fellows was called up, and they just stayed in Ottawa all the time and just fooled around, you might say. However, I got a very nice letter back outlining the various things that I'd have to go in as flight lieutenant, but then I probably could expect rather rapid promotion, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to the recruiting office and showed it to them. They were a little startled about it, I think. But in any event, I forget now what they told me, but then something came up again and made it practically impossible for me to get away for a while. And I gradually, by that time, the war was starting to turn a little bit. And
the airplane plan would be in full swing.
Oh, yes, it'd still be in full swing, but I didn't want to get into that. That was one thing, being stuck in one station all the time. Oh, well, that's
they wouldn't send you overseas, though, would they?
Well, I don't know. That's what I wanted.
Well, the age...
The age limit, yeah, but then I felt that I could be of some use over there, perhaps not in active service, but in some administrative position, you see.
Well, a lot of ex-RFC and then later RCF, and then came back and they ended up as wing commanders, I think of Duke and Horsfield, and they came back as wing commanders.
Yeah. Well, I can name you one, two, three, four, at least four sergeant pilots who were sergeant pilots of me became wing commanders.
Is that right?
And I had the corporal, my crewman,
mm-hmm.
who was an engineer, who was, he was a maintenance man.
Mm-hmm.
He became a wing commander in charge of quality control, I think it was, down in Toronto. Down in one of the big manufacturing plants.
Yeah. So you sort of missed the second one. You were on the outskirts of the second one, the second war, due to your provincial service, and then by the time you could get in. It was almost too late.
Well, it was almost too late. I couldn't. We pared the air service down. We only had. I think I was the only pilot left there, as a matter of fact, and I was doing not a lot of flying, but I was keeping pretty busy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I know one for Roy Brown. Remember Roy Brown?
Roy Brown.
Roy Brown said to me one day, well, said to his people there, he said, well, Jim Allman comes in, gets out of the aircraft, hops into another one, is away again.
That's probably the Pony Express.
Yeah. We were down to seven people, as a matter of fact, still doing our aircraft overhauls. We kept one man on. He was called up, but we managed to keep him on. And he was the engine overall man.
Hmm.
And some of them left. I should say a number of them left. I forget just how many people we had on in the air service at that time, but we had several pilots. And so on. However, that's the way it was.
Now, you remained with the Manitoba Air Service until 1962.
1962, right.
And you retired as director of the service.
Right, yeah. I was appointed director in 1946.
So you were director from 46 to 62?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, is the air service still going today, do you know?
Yeah.
The Manitoba Air Service?
Yeah, yeah.
And,
it's now called the Air Division.
Mm-hmm.
And great changes have taken place there.
You wouldn't recognize the place, eh?
Well, I visited the Lac-Devanie headquarters
mm-hmm.
when I was down there, and it's the building is still there. They've got about three aircraft located there, but their main activity is in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
Flying, everybody?
The old centralization planes.
What happened was this. The chap that took my place, he was in the second command at Lac-Devanie. He took over. He's still at Lac-Devanie, but not in charge. He resigned, actually, pulled out, retired early, I should say, because of the pressure. And a chap from the Good Roads Department took over, and he was full of ambition, and he built that thing up, and he had a pull apparently with Schreier of the NDP government of Manitoba,
our present government
because he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars. He had a fleet of over 30 aircraft at one time. They bought a Japanese designed aircraft that was made up at Gimli. They had started a factory up there. I think they sold three of them. The government, Manitoba government bought one. And it's an absolute lemon. I was told that. They stole a lemon. I told them that when I was down here. The thing was always going to have trouble.
Well, when you were director, you had what, otters?
Yeah, we had otters and beavers. We started out with five vedettes. We bought two more.
This would be in 32.
This was in 32. Well, we started out with five vedettes. Given to us by the Air Service, by the Royal Canadian Air Service, Air Force, for the sum of $1 just to legalize the transaction, along with a whole bunch of, they just dumped a whole bunch of supplies in there, not marked at all. I spent the first winter sorting out the parts and put it established as sort of a parts place in there. Anyway, I'm skipping from one thing to the other. But, as soon as the, this chap, Campbell, he was interested, he was working hard to establish a provincial or a commercial air service, actually, between Winnipeg, Regina, and Prince Albert, in conjunction with some people in Saskatchewan who had the same idea. And they worked for a couple of years trying to get a license to do this thing, and it wasn't granted. Well, okay, that was that. But he had, in the summertime, he had about 20 pilots in there, you know. And it was way overdone. But they kept at it anyway. Well, as soon as the Conservative government got in, well, they slashed it right down. I think they've got 13 aircraft there now.
Is that right?
Most of them based in Winnipeg. One thing that he did do, I will say this, he established, through his connections with the Department of Land, Good Roads. Public Works. He got them to establish landing strips at many of the outlying points, Barron's River, Norway House, Island Lake, possibly God's Lake. I'm not sure about God's Lake. So that they could get in on wheels, you see. That was one thing. There was a gap. We had a freeze-up period in the fall. We always had kept two aircraft up at the Paw. And they could start flying on skis around the 10th of November. We couldn't start flying on skis. In fact, we could fly on floats up pretty close to the 10th of November. But we couldn't go too far north, you see. But there wasn't too much of a gap between Lac Da Bonnie flying, the end of Lac Da Bonnie flying, and the start of the Paw flying. And the same in the spring. They flew later than we could start, you see. But that's how it worked out. But there were times, there was a period in the fall and a period in the spring when aircraft on floats or skis couldn't move.
Now, your flying career has now stretched from, 1917 to 1962?
Yeah, right.
And when's the last time you were at the controls? Do you recall?
Well, I stopped active flying about 1958, somewhere in there. I'm not sure just when. Partly because one of the reasons. I made a trip with the deputy minister and somebody else, I forget now, up in the Paw area, and we ran into fairly heavy rain, rainstorm, before we got into the Paw. And while I was flying actively, and it wouldn't have bothered me, but I found that I was a little out of practice in flying in very bad weather. The second reason was that I had six or eight pilots in Lac Da Bonnie who wanted to fly, anxious to put in time. Why should I take, when I didn't need to fly, when I should take time from them? The third thing was that usually on a trip, I would have to go in, do the refueling, perhaps move some drums of gas and so on and so forth, take a gas account and so on. And it was fairly hard work. And I was, I thought to myself, well, I'm foolish. There's no sense in me being proud enough to keep up my flying license, pilot's license, mm-hmm. when I've got these other people to fly me around.
Sure. I'd have to do that with a car.
Yeah.
I'd have a chauffeur myself.
Sure, sure.
I don't care if I never drive again.
Yeah.
But you never felt that way about flying, though, did you? You really liked it.
Yeah, I like flying, yes. I like the work that I was doing. I really did. I had a very enjoyable life in aviation. I had some close calls. I was.
You're still here to talk about it again, but that close.
the other day, we were driving. My daughter has a minute. This is Manitoba. My daughter has a cottage on Lake Winnipeg, and about 15 miles from Pine Falls, which is down on the Winnipeg River. And we were driving up there to have a game of golf with my son-in-law and I. And we passed a place just before cutting the Pine Falls, where I probably had as close a call as anywhere. I'd had a forest ranger. There was a lot of heavy fires and heavy smoke all down the, well, actually in Lac-Devanny. But I knew the country so well, I figured I could get through, you see. But then I ran into fog, and fog and smoke is the worst possible combination, and I decided I better turn around and come back. So I was following the river down, so I made a right-hand turn so I could watch the river. I could see myself doing it, you see. And I came back got over the river all right, and as I came back, I don't know just what happened, but I lost my horizon. Everything blanked out. I may have climbed just a little bit in the turn, I'm not sure. And there I was, pointed across the river, without any horizon, without any instruments to speak of, and a nose-heavy aircraft. The aircraft was nose-heavy. And I knew I was coming down. I was trying to keep the airspeed up a little bit. I didn't dare to keep it up too much. But I could tell that I was going down. And then, all of a sudden, I saw the outline of a huge wood pile. I don't suppose I was more than 100 feet from it, but I knew right away where I was, because I knew where there was a wood pile that was put up by the Hudson's Bay Company, I think it was.
Oh, that's crazy. Well, Mr. Allman, I think we got here today,
yeah.
And thank you very much for making the time. It was fascinating.
Yeah, well, that's fine.
Thank you very much, sir.